This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
As the daughter of a diplomat, Cherry Murray spent much of her childhood moving. Before she left for college, she and her family lived in the United States, Japan, Pakistan, Korea, and Indonesia. Although Murray studied art in her time overseas, a 10th grade chemistry class struck a chord in her. The artistic idea of simple mathematical equations describing the world resonated with her background. She earned a BA and PhD in physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and after interning at Bell Labs, went to work there full-time in 1978. Murray is known for her study of light scattering and imaging, and is a leader in the study of surface and condensed matter physics. She served as Senior Vice President for Bell Labs Research, Lucent Technologies, and a Deputy Director for Science and Technology at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, before being named Dean of the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Murray is a member of both the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering, and is the current president of the American Physical Society.
You grew up the child of Army or service parents, so you did a lot of moving, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. My father was a diplomat. He was in World War II in the Army. Then he went to Yale. Yale is a university where a lot of the Foreign Service people, alumni, go. And he met up with a bunch of people and got interested in the Foreign Service. His first job after he graduated from Yale was teaching English in a private school in Tucson, Arizona. He eventually became headmaster of the private school. Then World War II came along. He volunteered to become an officer, was assigned to Europe. He loved it. And he then moved into the Foreign Service, assigned to embassies, except for a small stint during the Korean War. See, I was born in Kansas, Fort Riley, when he was assigned to, I guess it was officer training for the Korean War. And I lived there exactly 6 months, and then we moved around, first to Washington, and then back to Tucson when he was overseas in Korea. Then at age 2, we moved to Japan, and he moved to the embassy in Japan. And at age 6, we moved back to the U.S. for a year, and then to Pakistan for 3 years, and then back to the U.S. for a year, then to Japan again for about 4 years. Then we family lived in Washington, D.C., while he was in Vietnam in the embassy. In Saigon during the war, and then we moved to Korea for 2 years. Then I went to MIT, and my parents went to Indonesia for 3 years. The summers when I was at MIT, I went to Jakarta. So we moved about once a year.
Do you think that had any influence on your getting involved in science? I mean, obviously you would have had a good view of the world.
Yeah, I think so, because well, my mother was an artist, fine artist. My father was, he majored in English literature, but they met in an art colony in Taos, New Mexico. They were not scientists. However, my older brother, who's 9 years older, was a product of Sputnik era. And when we were in Pakistan, there really was no school that he could go to. My mother taught me, but he was sent back to the States to go to school. He went to Choate in Connecticut and decided to get into science. So that had a big influence on me. Of all of the women that I know of about my age who are in science, Americans I'm talking about, they've either lived overseas or traveled a lot or had some foreign education. And I was wondering, I mean, it's just so amazingly common that I was wondering whether that got people into science or whether what I think is probably more likely, the school system in the U.S. pushes girls out of science. I think that's more likely. because I certainly was not encouraged to do science. I mean, my parents are both artists. They didn't discourage me. But I remember I had a huge argument with my parents to get them to allow me to have piano lessons, which you would think is the opposite. Because both my brothers had done music and they had stopped it, and so they're just not going to, you know, the third child, you know. No. But I did win that argument, and I got piano, took piano lessons, and I took dance, and I always took private art lessons wherever we were. Sumiya, which is ink brush painting in Japan. And I had very, very good art lessons in Korea. And so I was definitely not pushed into science.
I read somewhere that your brother kind of gave you a bit of a taunting when
yeah,
he was at MIT, saying you could never do that.
That was when I was in high school, yeah.
Was your brother somewhat of an influence also?
I think he was. He was very, very interested in physics in particular. He got interested in space physics, but then he went into lasers. And he decided to go to MIT from Choate. He had actually left home when I was six. So, you know, he came back every now and then, but he did not live at home because we were overseas. But when he was in graduate school and I was looking for a place to go to college, I was in Seoul, Korea, he came back and said, I would never survive MIT and definitely not physics. And so I, of course, applied there. MIT has alumni interview prospective students, and I was interviewed by the once crown prince of Korea, who was an MIT graduate in architecture. So he actually came to our house, and he was a great guy. I really liked that interview. He was a really neat person. And I got in, so I decided to go there.
That's interesting, because he's an arts person more
right.
than science, too. Well,
that's true.
Sort of on the cusp, I guess.
Yeah. I decided in 10th grade, which was in Alexandria, Virginia. I was in school. I was doing very well in art, and I had entered several exhibits and won second place and won first place for one painting and one drawing. But the thing that got me into science, other than my brother, the negative aspect of it, was I was put in a chemistry class because I had been in accelerated classes. They decided to put me in this new class with a new teacher called Chem Study. So this was one of the earlier attempts at trying to get more hands-on science earlier. And this was a very tough class, and I loved it. And the teacher was extremely tough. He was in school going after his master's degree in chemistry. And it was his first time he had ever taught high school kids. And I was in 9th grade in a 10th grade accelerated class, but I absolutely could not get enough out of it. And the thing that I liked the best about it was thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, because it was just very simple mathematical equations described the world. It was just truly amazing. And I really like that. And that decided me right then and there to go into science as a career and have art as a hobby rather than the opposite.
This was 10th grade?
10th grade.
So you already were doing some pretty advanced work at that age. But the type of science you went into eventually, how does the chem studies work feed into that, or did it?
I liked the more physics part. I mean, statistical mechanics and thermodynamics are really more physical chemistry than they are organic and synthetic chemistry.
I know you have obviously a very strong visual sense, and your work, a lot of the things you've worked on since then have had some element of visual.
That's true.
At that point, was there anything like that that drew you in also?
What I remember, I mean, the visual elements, not much, is that this professor had a canary in the classroom, which is kind of odd. I don't know. I mean, we certainly did, you know, putting two clear things together and it turns purple and that. And I liked that, but I really, really liked the mathematics.
So how did you continue that after 10th grade up until you went into MIT?
I went into Seoul American High School, which had most 100 kids in it, the whole high school. I had 30 kids in the graduating class. And the thing that I remember about that, it was very close-knit school because it was pretty small. Mostly diplomats, but it was on a Air Force base. And there really was not a physics teacher. The algebra teacher was the physics teacher, and she really didn't know physics. So I read physics on my own, which may or may not have helped me understand physics, because I had done chemistry already. The thing that I most remember about Seoul High School was Seoul in the winter, it has a pretty tough climate. In the winter, the Gobi Desert winds come down, and it's extremely dry and very, very cold. There are icicles hanging everywhere. A reasonable amount of snow, but very cold, like below zero for months. So I certainly remember that about it. And the summers were the exact opposite. The wind from the south would come up and it would be extremely humid and extremely hot. So I got somewhat interested in geology and ecology and climatology just from the extremes of climate. But what they had for me to read was physics, and I did kind of like physics. It was a little bit more boring than the chemistry class, but not bad. And I decided that I wanted to go to MIT mostly because of my brother's taunt.
Aside from what you heard from your brother, you must have known that MIT had a great physics department.
Oh, yeah, and also that I could do pretty much anything at MIT, because I knew I wanted to go into science.
Did you have an idea what you would do once you got there, where you would start?
I decided that since I was coming from a very small school and had to do the reading myself, that I would go into what they call seminar classes. I figured that I would be behind everyone else, and I think that I actually had an advantage thinking that, because most of the class were either valedictorians or, you know, way up in very good schools like Bronx School of Science, etc. And they were used to being number one, and suddenly they were put together with a whole bunch of people who were exactly the same as them. And I expected to be way behind everyone else because I hadn't been in these fancy schools. And taking a seminar class was a very good idea. A seminar class was the same group of kids would study calculus and physics together in a more, here's the calculus that would be necessary for the physics, instead of having calculus separate in a lecture class and physics separate in a big lecture, it would be only 20 or 25 kids. And in that class, I got to talk to the professor and got very interested in condensed matter physics because of that. And I think that and the fact that I really liked statistical mechanics way back in 10th grade got me interested.
Did you know about condensed matter physics before you'd gotten to MIT? Or?
Not really. I mean, I certainly was exposed to the chemistry, and I had come across semiconductor equations, and I thought that was kind of boring. But I got more and more interested as I found out what people were doing in their research. And so the first research that I started out to do was to make a superconducting bolometer for an astrophysics experiment. I was also very interested in astrophysics, went to that astrophysics colloquia. But the people who were doing experimental, and I definitely wanted to be experimental, I mean, hands-on was very important for me. The people who were doing astrophysics were making detectors and doing electronics. And that, and also this first course in physics, got me interested in the more solid-state and materials physics aspects. You could be doing physics, learning about the universe, but making stuff. So I did as a freshman and undergraduate, research in making superconducting bolometers, and I really enjoyed that. But I went to a seminar course where various professors talked about their research. I got very, very interested in one professor's work. He was studying superfluid helium. I've been using it on the superconducting bolometer. And so I started reading books on helium. And I went to his office and you know, asked him if I could do a research project as a sophomore. And he said, sure, what would you like to do? and at the time he had just started doing some light scattering work on superfluid helium, and that was very exciting to me. So I ended up doing my senior thesis in his group. I worked for several years in his group. The first year I built it was actually sonic, not ultrasound, a method of measuring helium-3 and the helium-4 gas, a very accurate method by having basically a transducer and a microphone that I made, electret microphones and a gas, a chamber, and you filled it with helium gas, and by looking at the speed of sound, you could tell how much helium-3 was in it, if you knew what the pressure was. Then I graduated to making a Fabry-Perot spectroscopy setup, and I made the whole thing, machine shop and everything, to look at superfluid helium, and learned how to work a home-built helium-3 refrigerator, and learned how to fix, mostly, a home-built helium-3 and dilution fridge, and built some of it, and ended up doing my thesis, looking at high-resolution light scattering from the bound state of 2 rotons in helium-4. And it was a big question at the time whether there was a bound state and what was a roton, elementary excitation in superfluid helium.
Sounds as though you were doing everything from soup to nuts on that.
Yeah, and I really like that, building from ground, you know, design the experiment, decide what you're going to do, start building it.
Create the technology you need.
Yep.
So there's a lot of engineering involved.
Yes, indeed. And a lot of solid state, the detectors. Well, the lasers were gas lasers. Then when I was looking for graduate school, I actually liked doing the research a whole lot better than I liked doing the coursework. The coursework was fine, but the research really excited me. And I definitely wanted to become an experimentalist.
It sounds as though also from the beginning of your undergraduate studies, when you were working on the superconducting bolometer, you were already working in an interdisciplinary manner. You had astronomers,
yeah.
So that was kind of setting the stage for your later career.
Of course, high-energy physicists, experimentalists, definitely do that. They've got to be very good engineers as well as understand the physics. And I like that part of it. The elementary excitations in superfluid helium are not unlike, except somewhat different, but they're not unlike elementary excitations in strings, right, for string theory, or super high energy. They're just much lower energy. But they're very similar. The concepts are very similar. The particles that you think of, like an electron or whatever, leptons, are elementary excitations of the vacuum. And the elementary excitations in condensed matter, like phonons, or in this case, these are elementary excitations in a liquid, so they're like sound waves, they're quantized. But a roton, you know, sound waves have a curve of energy versus momentum. So as you change the momentum, you get to higher and higher energy. In solids, this comes down again, back to zero zone, and it folds back and just goes over and over and over again, because it's a completely regular bunch of atoms together. And these are the excitations of the atoms bouncing against each other, so sound waves. In a liquid, sound may exist down at very long wavelengths, but it just peters out and the excitations don't exist anymore, because the atoms in a liquid, they can't run into each other, and there's a certain distance they are apart, but they're not ordered. They're kind of random in a shell around each other, and they're constantly moving. Sound is just atoms moving against each other. In a crystalline solid, the atoms are rigidly attached to each other through bonds, which you can think of as springs. They're really electrons, but they're shared electrons, and that makes it springy. And they can't move around. They're fixed rigidly, but they can vibrate. And these sound waves, these vibrations, they're quantized. They're actually quantum mechanical. Particularly when you get to helium, which is very low temperature, and up to about neon, they're quantum mechanical. The solids are quantum mechanical, which means you can move an atom into another atom. You can actually exchange, and they're exactly the same, and they do that. They have enough energy they can actually switch. And in superfluid helium, instead of dipping down back to zero again and actually coming around to the same place. It dips down and keeps going. So it tries very hard to be a solid, but it doesn't quite make it. And it was never clear what a roton was. Feynman's idea of what the roton was, because he worked on superfluid helium, and he actually calculated what this curve was. His idea was these are just normal sound modes where the atoms are either just longitudinal or transverse sound. So they're bouncing against each other this way, or they're bouncing this way, and this perturbance moves. Here, he thought of it as some kind of core of atomic scale. He has no idea what the core was, but something, with fluid flow that's going around like that. So it's a little vortex ring. And this thing could move. It had a certain energy, and it could move. In fact, it moves very fast, and it's a very long-lived excitation. And there's a high density of states, so there were a lot of them within a certain energy.
And what were the rotons?
Rotons. These guys, it turns out, they're called maxons, because they're at the maximum, have a very short lifetime, but the rotons are very long-lived. And so my senior thesis was studying whether if you made one roton going this way and one going that way, they would form a bound state. And the calculations, if you just do a simple calculation of what the flow feels of the, if you assume they're vortex rings, some kind of quantized vortex ring, you put them together, you would actually minimize the energy and the flow feels by bringing them close together if they're going opposite directions. Mm. And so the prediction was that if you create equal and opposite rotons together, they would form a bound state, a very long-lived bound state. And so I searched by two photon excitation, creating two rotons. Is this energy below where the neutron scattering sees it, or is it exactly where it is? And it had to be very accurately measured. And what I discovered is, yes, it was below that. And in fact, there was some controversy over neutron measurements. And I got a very accurate measurement of where this should be, because the shape of the, it actually had a Fano line shape. If it were not going to be a bound state, it would have been a peak right at the neutron energy, where this one's twice the energy of one state, but instead it was below that. But I also knew what the line shape was, and the line shape was exactly as calculated, and that predicted where the twice the single state was going to be, and that turned out to be different from where at least one neutron measurement had it. A subsequent neutron measurement with better accuracy put it exactly where I had seen it. So it determined that, sure enough, there is a bound state of two rotons.
So what are implications to your findings that a bound state was created? Is that like a phase transition?
There would be a phase transition if you had enough of them created. If you just have two of them and they're going equal and opposite, they have only one wave vector dimension, this minor point, because the dip occurs only at that wave vector. The wave vector is basically a velocity. So if you create two of them going in equal and opposite direction, they will have a lower energy than two separate ones. And that's actually relevant for people who are looking at measuring high energy particles by using helium, because you end up creating bound states of these rotons. But it's also just an interesting quantum mechanical calculation.
And this is your undergrad work?
Yeah, it's my undergrad work. So then when I was looking for graduate school, I was pretty independent doing my undergraduate thesis, and my thesis advisor had been doing a sabbatical that year anyway. So he was Tom Greytek, who's still a very good friend of mine. He was doing actually a sabbatical with John Wheatley at San Diego. And I came out and looked at a number of California schools. My parents were in Indonesia at the time. So I looked at Stanford, Berkeley, San Diego, because I went to visit Tom there, and La Jolla. And I interviewed astrophysics groups, because I was still very interested in astrophysics. and the solid state and applied physics group at Stanford. And I came away with the impression that I could do the best research at MIT, and I could do different things. And I was heavily recruited to stay there, but I didn't want to do the same type of thing for my thesis, so I decided to do surface physics and light scattering. It was completely different, but it was light scattering. And I, for better or worse, I'm not sure what, decided on a project which would be to look at molecules hopping on and off the surface of whatever, which whatever I finally decided was porous glass, because there would be enough molecules to actually see if you had a high enough density surface. So I wanted to look at porous glass just because it was, first of all, transparent, which is very important when you're trying to do light scattering, and second, had a very high internal surface area. So I learned how to clean it. I built my own. By then, you couldn't really buy vacuum equipment. We were just beginning to be able to buy seals. So I spent a lot of time machining gold seals. You know, most people use copper seals now, but I made aluminum seals and gold seals for ultra-high vacuum. Machined stainless, a very clean aluminum, machined a lip on it and cut into the aluminum to seal. Spent a lot of time doing that, which was a lot of fun. Did a huge amount of plumbing.
Is this all stuff you figure out as you go along?
Mm-hmm. I learned how to machine from the older graduate students in the machine shop. It was a graduate machine shop at MIT. And one of the people who was there constantly, was a great teacher for me, was Bill Phillips.
Who went to NIST,
yeah. But he machined his entire experiment when he was at MIT. And I did also. I probably didn't have to, but it was just at the point where you're beginning to be able to buy things. I did buy a vacuum pump. I didn't make the vacuum pump. And I did this experiment and actually learned a lot about how to clean glass, that's for sure. Because I ended up having to bake it in hydrogen and all sorts of nasty things. I learned about surface phonons on silica and the phonon spectrum of silica, and did an experiment where I could see various molecules, ammonia being a nice one, sit on a Lewis acid base, an OH group on the silica, and I could see everything about the spectrum. And the graduate student who was doing the theory for my experiment was Bob Laughlin, who was doing a beta lattice calculation. And it turned out he was doing silica, and he could calculate the normal modes, and it matched beautifully. I did Raman scattering, inelastic light scattering, like the helium, and also infrared reflectivity. So I decided I liked surface science and I wanted to do infrared spectroscopy. I did a summer assignment at Bell Labs.
Because you were at one point thinking about going into academia, weren't you?
I was definitely thinking about going into academia, but I got an IBM fellowship, and it occurred to me kind of out of the blue that maybe it would be nice to go to an industrial lab to work for the summer in the middle of my thesis. And I went to talk to my thesis advisor, who is now back, who had just gotten tenure, by the way. And I walked into his office and I said, I was thinking, you know, now that I have this IBM fellowship, what if I went off to IBM for a summer? And he literally fell off his chair. And I thought to myself, whoops. This was not a good thing to suggest. Oh, well. And I kind of backed out of my room and said, never mind. However, the next day he came to my office, which is around the hall, and said, you should go to Bell Labs. You know, forget this IBM stuff. Because he had been to Bell Labs and he thought it was a fantastic experience. He had been an undergraduate, had done an internship. He was actually an electrical engineering undergraduate from MIT. So I think Bob Virginio by that time had already come from Bell Labs and was at MIT. And Tom, my thesis advisor, arranged with Bob Virginio for me to go and look to see what group I could work in. And when I did that, I decided I really liked light scattering, but I didn't want to do something on surfaces, which is what I was doing at MIT. So I chose a plasma physics experiment. I work with Dick Slusher. And we wrote it up later. We were looking for nonlinear Landau damping of plasma modes. We never saw that. We saw classic linear Landau damping. But it was a beautiful demonstration of that. And it involved using a 100-watt CO2 laser to scatter light. It's a 10-micron light, so infrared. Scatter light off of ion acoustic waves in a positive column. So I got to do the plumbing to put the positive column together. And the plasma worked really nicely. And the laser was dead for most of the summer. Finally got the leaks out of the laser and just got the experiment going. And one of the things that happened during that time, you found the beam of the laser by taking a meter stick and going like that. It would burst out in flame so you could see where the beam was because it was pretty high power. One of the laser's mirrors, or the laser was actually about 12 feet long. It's a huge laser. It was one of these industrial metal cutting lasers. But the optics were not, I would say, optimal. On the mirror that came right out of the laser came, hit a mirror. This mirror was sticky taped onto its mount. Well, it heated up because it was kind of a hot laser. And yeah, there was enough absorption that it heated up the mirror and it just went shoo. And it fell, and as it fell, the laser beam scanned across the room and cut through an electrical cord and, you know, various things. And then the laser beam went right out the window, and it burned a hole in the window.
Oh, my God.
That was my experience with high-power lasers. So I did learn a lot about, do not use sticky tape on optics.
And safety.
Yeah. It didn't hurt anyone, but it could have.
Yeah.
Also, the ion acoustic, the experiment just got to work by the very end of the summer, so I had to come back and do some more experiments. I also learned another thing. We put deuterium in the plasma to see if we could change. It was a hydrogen plasma. It was an argon plasma with either hydrogen or deuterium to damp the modes, the ion acoustic modes. And put deuterium in, and it did exactly the same thing as hydrogen. Very unlike what one would have expected. And it turned out that was because the deuterium was sitting on the walls and knocking hydrogen out. And so it looked like hydrogen, it was hydrogen. And I learned that lesson and what to do about it from Sam McCall, who was a theorist wandering around. And, you know, I was explaining to him this, you know, I put deuterium in, it didn't look any different from hydrogen. And he said, well, you should measure the spectrum of the plasma, see if there's any deuterium there. So I learned a lot about doing experiments and, you know, not too clever, but...
And the value of having a theorist.
Yes, well, the value of thinking about, well, you know, what could possibly be happening here? Because he was exactly right. And once I learned that, then I understood how to put deuterium in and actually even measure the concentration.
While you were doing this work and even some of the earlier work, were you thinking of how it could be applied? Was that at all in your mind?
Not at all. No, it was just really cool, except for maybe if you're making a detector for astrophysics.
Yeah.
You know, you're trying to make a detector. But
coming to Bell Labs, you were free to just do the research.
Yeah, it was just doing plasma physics research then. And when I eventually came to Bell Labs, I was heavily recruited here because I'd been here for a summer. I had a great time that summer. I really enjoyed it. I wanted to get into doing infrared on metals, surfaces, and I built an ultra-high vacuum system. And then a very interesting thing happened in various universities around the world, in both Southampton in England and, I guess, Chicago, Northwestern. A guy who was a chemist in Southampton was doing light scattering from metals, molecules on a surface. And he could actually see the molecule spectrum. And if you had calculated the cross sections, you would have said it's least 12 orders of magnitude too big. It can't possibly be seeing this molecule absorbed on the metal, so there must be something wrong here. But it couldn't be 12 orders of magnitude more molecules. So something weird was happening, and that turned out to be surface-enhanced Raman scattering. So even though I wanted to do infrared, this came, and so a number of people at Bell Labs decided they had to check this out. Because it had been noted, somebody in the audience had done the calculation and said, this can't be right. How can you possibly be seeing that effect? It was pretty clear they saw the effect. Went back to his lab at Northwestern, repeated the experiment, saw exactly the same thing. So something weird was happening. And so I started building another experiment to try this out. I had talked to people and thought, you know, since I had done Raman scattering, there were a bunch of lasers I could borrow. Why not try this out? Because it was an interesting effect. And as it turned out, I did two separate experiments and I collaborated with people while my other vacuum chamber was getting built. One of them was in ultra-high vacuum, and it was a collaboration with Chuck Shank, who was then at Homedahl, but he lent the laser, and I forget who lent the vacuum system. Somebody else lent the vacuum system. And with Chuck's postdoc, we did a very careful ultra-high vacuum experiment and discovered that, sure enough, on silver surfaces that were clean, very, very clean, you could see an enhancement of 10 to the 4. It wasn't 10 to the 12, but they were kind of messy surfaces that people had electrochemically polished with a whole lot of surface area and stuff. So, you know, it was definitely an enhancement. We could measure it. And in another experiment I did with a chemist putting monolayers onto silver films and then spacing the monolayers out, measured the distance dependence of this. And then we decided to measure it by putting layer upon layer in ultra-high vacuum and measure the distance dependence, and discovered that it was actually pretty large. It wasn't just the molecule attached to the surface, but it was really an electromagnetic effect. Well, it turns out to be both. And so, you know, my career was deflected probably by 4 or 5 years in doing these experiments.
How did you find the people to collaborate with if they were even in a whole other location? Do you just talk to people and they'll say, oh,
yeah, try so-and-so, he has a laser. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was a very collaborative atmosphere.
Well, that's always been one of the hallmarks, right?
Right. Bell Labs, yeah. Well, the hallmark has been two-sided. People competing with each other and people collaborating with mm-hmm. each other. And they do both. But this happened to be one of the most competitive people in the world, Chuck Shank, wanting to do an experiment very quickly and therefore wanting to collaborate. And it was Jack Rowe's surface physics chamber that we modified, put windows on. And Jack Rowe is a wonderful person, just incredibly nice guy. And he got Chuck and me together because I was interested and Chuck was interested. And the other one was I was just walking around talking to people in the hallway and found Dave Alera, who put the molecules down for me.
But it's always been a bit of an interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. people that are not working exactly in your field, that you'll
right.
be nearby.
Yeah, and I could not have put the monolayers down that Dave Alera did, because he really understood about self-assembled monolayers, and I didn't know a thing about it. I was, you know, doing vacuum, you know, ammonia was about as good a molecule as I could think of earlier. And I could not have done all the silver evaporations without help. So then I got very interested, was talking with a friend of mine, Tony Tyson. He was working on using CCDs for astronomy. CCDs were invented at Bell Labs way back about 50 years ago. They were not invented as detectors. They were invented as shift registers, storage devices. But they turned out to be wonderful detectors, and Tony was working on using them for astronomy. There weren't really any commercial CCDs yet, but I looked at what he was doing and thought, boy, this would be fantastic to do spectroscopy. You know, use that as an area detector instead of a phototube, which is a real pain, and you only get one very small bit of the spectrum and you have to scan it, get it all at once, and then you could get a factor of 100 enhancement, and then you could forget having to do this weird surface enhancement. You could look at molecules on surfaces without having the electromagnetic enhancement effect. And so working with Tony and his friend who he had roomed with at Stanford and now had his own shop out of Mount Lassen in his own house in a cabin in Mount Lassen, building detectors, the electronics that would read out the CCD. I actually went to visit him there and he was quite eccentric, but he built a wonderful detector and I put it on a big grating spectrometer and started doing molecule spectroscopy on surfaces, either enhanced or not enhanced, and looked at a number of things, such as what happened when you put down these Langmuir-Blodgett layers or self-assembled monolayers, who are also, at least the self-assembled monolayers, were where there's a sulfur, then a long carbon chain, hydrocarbon chain, and then whatever you wanted on the top of it, would go down in a very ordered fashion. These were the same molecules that we used as spacers in one of the experiments, but now we're looking at the molecules themselves. And because of the detector getting 100 times more light in at once, you could actually see the signal from molecules that were on a single monolayer on a surface, and looked at the ordering and disordering of the monolayer.
Did the spectroscopy work lead to your interest in colloids?
About that time, I went to a talk, I guess at the American Physical Society meeting, and saw Noel Clark, who was a liquid crystal physicist, give a talk about colloids and colloidal crystals. He was doing light scattering from colloids. He's an old light scattering person, and so light scattering people kind of go around in the same community. And as I was sitting through that talk, I thought, this is absolutely beautiful. Why doesn't he just look at it?
Your former life coming
Yes,
out.
My former life. And so I thought, why don't I look at it? And so I got some colloid that was a little bit bigger than his, so that it would be easier to see in a microscope. And I borrowed a microscope from somebody.
How do you get colloid?
You buy it. You can just buy it from. Mm-hmm. It's made in batches, huge batches. Monodisperse from maybe up to about 1 micron in diameter. Then it's not very monodisperse after that. But it's made by emulsion polymerization. And if you get the emulsion exactly temperature uniform, you can get extremely monodisperse colloid, because it grows in little bubbles, and the bubbles are all the same size. It polymerizes into the bubbles. And that was discovered in the 50s by people at Dow Corning. So you could buy this from Dow Corning. Anyway, I bought a little jar of this, suspended in water. I put it in a microscope slide, and I could see it really well, and I could see all sorts of cool effects with the particles interacting with each other. So I decided that I really wanted to do that, and I would like to study two-dimensional melting on a modulated surface, and I could make the modulated surface, or that is to say, I could have one made by people who had electron microscopes. They would do that for me. And I asked Jerry Dolan if he would make a little dimpled surface, because I wanted to study phase transitions on dimpled surfaces. And he said, oh, sure. And the next day, he came with one. So yes, I could get that done. I mean, didn't want it quite that quickly. But. So I designed, in the usual fashion, a very fancy cell, which had a viewing window, and it had sapphire, and it could be closed, so there would be a single layer of colloid, about 1 micron, and would be flat to that accuracy, and leak tight, and it was completely gold plated, because any metal put ions in the solution and that destroyed the colloid. And it had micrometer screws that you could turn and get everything perfect.
How long does it take to just design something like that?
Probably about 2 months, something like that. And then it was machined carefully in the shops here. It was made of copper because it wanted the temperature to be constant. It was maybe overkill after the fact, but it worked very well, except sapphire was deadly for the colloid. Too rough, could not get smooth sapphire. So I ended up using glass, which was very, very smooth, and it worked fine. And then I had a real fun time looking at two-dimensional melting. And I decided to start out with flat plates first because I wanted to see it without the bumps. And probably ended up being 2 years before I put any bumps down to look at, because the flat plates just had a plethora of interesting things to study. And I ended up, I think it was probably true that at the time that I was doing these experiments, there was a prediction in only two dimensions by Kosterlitz and Thallus, and then Halperin and Nelson after that, looked at it for the case of melting. But two-dimensional solid is in the same universality class as superfluid helium and XY superconductors, two-dimensional. And superconductors have a very bizarre phase transition called the Kosterlitz-Thallus transition, because it was predicted by Kosterlitz and Thallus, where it's not a first-order transition. It's a very gradual transition. And so Halperin and Nelson had looked at Kosterlitz and Thallus' paper and said, wait a minute, this is also true for two-dimensional solids, if you could get a two-dimensional solid. And in fact, if you look at more carefully, there's another order parameter. It's not just a vector order parameter, but they're two vector order parameters. One is the angular orientation of the lattice, and the other is the positional orientation of the lattice. And so they predicted two separate continuous melting transitions instead of a single first-order melting transition that we have in three dimensions. And so I set out to see whether that was the case. And a number of, I'd say four or five different people who did simulations had already simulated the case. And in fact, Bob Bergineau, the same Bob Bergineau who had been to MIT from Bell Labs, had done some experiments with argon on the surface of graphite. Very flat surface.
Simulations were done on the computer?
Yeah, these simulations were done on the computer, but the experiments were done with X-ray scattering with argon or krypton or any rare gas on graphite, which is a very smooth surface. And neither the simulations nor the experiments had found Kosterlitz-Thallus transition. That all found first-order phase transitions. So there was quite a bit of controversy in the general surface physics community, I suppose you could say, about whether this was even true or not. And so I learned about this after the fact. I mean, I didn't learn about all of this controversy until I actually started doing the experiments.
And you were already working?
I was already working with a very uniform, extremely flat, and very spherical spheres, who were very highly charged, and with ion exchange resin and trying to keep them as clean as possible, no leaks, etc. And I actually saw a continuous melting transition. And after the fact, of course, always after the fact, and after two separate groups had redone their simulations with many, many more particles, they were able to do it. You know, getting Anderson, for example, at Stanford, had done a simulation first, and then when I went out to talk to him, we came to the realization that my system was very different from what he was simulating, in that just by accident, I guess, my system had a lot of vacancies in it. They're very highly charged, and a vacancy was a pretty long-lived excitation, and there were at least 1% vacancies. And the simulators all had started out with complete full lattice and then tried to melt it. So even if you've looked at my crystal, it had quite a bit of vacancies in it. And it's just the way the crystal formed. I couldn't do anything about it because it was a crystal forming itself, self-assembling in some respects. But what the vacancies allowed was dislocations, which are the defects in the Kosterlitz-Thallus program, could climb much easier, so it could come into equilibrium. And I could actually watch dislocations move, glide, and climb. So I could tell exactly if my system was in equilibrium or not. And I could wait. I could let it sit for a month and come back to it. It's hard to do that with a simulation. So it turned out that you needed to have, 10,000 particles in order to see this effect without boundaries coming into play. And you needed to have a way of getting equilibrium. And then you would actually see the predicted behavior.
When you say see for this.
See is really seeing really in this see. Case. This okay, is yeah. really seeing.
You can see the transition.
Yep, you can see the little balls, and you can see where the dislocations are. And certainly with two dimensions, you can watch it equilibrate. You can see what happens if you perturb the system. And I did a lot of really cool experiments with putting electric fields on it and sloshing the crystal back and forth and seeing when it melted. And it also turns out that the colloid, very highly charged colloid, is not exactly the same as argon. And the glass surface is not exactly the same as graphite, because graphite has a hexagonal symmetry. And any calculated afterwards, of course, after the experiments were done, any hexagonal symmetry, a tiny bit of perturbation, would kill this effect, which is what Bob Bergeron was seeing. It was on, doesn't matter how flat graphite is, the crystal sits in the hollows of the graphite, so you can tell that they see slight different energy difference. And that was enough to completely wipe out the Coswell-Thales transition. But I did not have that, nor did Hans Andersen. He made a trick of having two crystal layers and allowing equilibration between the two layers so that he could equilibrate the crystals. And that would then look very much like what had been predicted by Halperin and Nelson. I could also measure the orientational order because I knew exactly where the atoms were. And so I could just do the calculation. And I could see that the orientational order at some point before the freezing transition, if you move from the liquid to the solid, was getting long range. And then it solidified. So there were really two transitions. But I couldn't tell whether the transition was first order or continuous. I couldn't see any discontinuity. And so that was so much fun, I decided to look at three-dimensional fluids and glasses and layers in between two dimensions and three dimensions.
What did you do after your decision to look at these three-dimensional fluids and glasses and their layers?
During that time, there were also a group of people at Bell Labs very interested in flux lattices in high TC superconductors or even low TC superconductors. And they had been doing electron microscopy imaging of these flux lattices, or AFM, atomic force magnification of flux lattices. And so they had these images, and so since I already had all my programs for calculating all these things, I collaborated with them and did the analysis of what the flux lattices were doing, and they were doing very bizarre things as well. In fact, they had hexadic order, which is the thing between, you have a long-range orientational order and short-range positional order. It was also observed in the flux lattices. Then I got heavily into management.
Right when you found your
colloids. Right when I, yes. But I still have some very nice data, actually, on measuring phase transitions in stripes. You have a striped potential well. Not like graphite, which has little holes that atoms can fall into, but stripes like steps on a surface, or this turns out to be just potential wells. And this gets very, very complex, and you just predict, forget three dimensions right now, which even gets more complex, but you just have a two-dimensional substance, let's just say spheres, so there's no directional bond order or anything. Then the prediction was that you would see a liquid as you change the density, say. It's either temperature or density, but keep temperature the same and change the density. You would see a liquid, so just moving around like a normal liquid. As you increase the density, it would lock into a solid, and then as you increase the density, it would become a liquid again. And that was because that was predicted by David Nelson, because he had been thinking about this Coswell-Thales-Halperin-Nelson in a bunch of potentials like this, and there are some dislocations that are pinned in this system that aren't in the other system. So they get pinned, and you, instead of having these two phase transitions from a liquid to a hexadic to a solid, You have liquid, solid, liquid. And so I wanted to look at that, and he had urged me to do these experiments. And so I got the stripes, and my postdoc did a spectacular job doing a beautiful experiment. And it did not look the way he predicted, because there was a lot more things going on. Maybe in one of the experiments, it turned out that we had a very bumpy unknown to us. There were lots of different, probably charged regions on the surface that repelled the spheres. So the spheres not only were seeing a nice potential like this, but there was all these hills in between. So that made it a lot more random and a lot more complex behavior. But also, it turned out in the experiment, even though we had predicted and done the estimation of what we thought the energy barrier was between being in one of these wells and hopping out, it was much larger than we predicted. And that was partly due to this charging on the surface that we didn't know until we actually did it. So what we found was, going from very low density, we had one-dimensional fluids in these wells. All the balls fell into wells, and it was really a one-dimensional fluid, which is really bizarre. And then we had a beautiful set of very complex phase behavior that David Nelson looked at and said, wow, this is really amazing. I haven't written that up yet.
So this is what's going on now?
This is what's going on right now.
Was that difficult for you to go into management from the point where you were just starting to work on the colloids?
Yes, but we had enough, I will say, crisis here that I really needed to focus on the management. So the management also means what is the right thing for Bell Labs research to be doing right now in the certain circumstances, and what kind of fundamental research is the right thing to be doing.
That's difficult to predict now at this point.
I think there's some obvious answers to that. The first is what's important for the future of telecommunications. And, you know, that has always been done at Bell Labs, but we've always done a whole lot more as well, because, you know, interesting science has kind of caused us to go off in various directions. My work with the colloids is studying phase transitions, which has a lot of relevance for a lot of different phase transitions, but maybe had a little bit of relevance for communications. Because in the midst of my interest in colloids, and I'm maybe proud of this, that because of my experiments, which were direct visualization experiments, a whole lot more groups got interested in this. So there's beautiful research getting done, not just my ex-postdocs and students and stuff, but other groups have done really beautiful things, much better physics than I have. So I'm very, very pleased to see that going on. And at the same time, the prediction, which is really a beautiful thing by Eli Yablonovich of photonic bandgap materials, came the idea that you could use colloid to create a photonic bandgap. And I have not done that, but a number of people have gone off and used techniques such as making templates and trying to grow crystals, which you can then fill with a higher index material and then maybe make a photonic bandgap.
Well, nanotechnology is also an area that's starting to be
That's right. These self-assembly things can be taken into the atomic realm. Argon atoms on, you know, little ridges would do exactly this, because it's classical spherical potentials and everything. Very strongly interacting molecules actually have chemical reactions that they do. But you can take some of these ideas in a colloidal, call it self-assembly, it's just phase transition, and use it with atoms as well. And that's interesting to me. I may end up going into that and do that. That may be the next thing I'm going to do.
And while all this is going on, you're also very active in promoting international collaboration.
Yes. Science is global.
And many of the places you lived, Pakistan, Korea, are very strongly affected by what's going on politically now. And, you know, I know it's difficult for a lot of people to get visas to come in as students or to work. For Bell Labs, obviously, you have to have good people coming in from all over.
That's true. It's probably more important in the universities than it is for Bell Labs, because we can have labs overseas.
That's true.
And we do. We have a lab in China, research lab in China, doing software. We will have a research lab in Ireland, and a research lab in India. And that's because those countries have fantastic resources of great PhDs, very, very good. I would say world class. And it's important for Lucent to be a global company and to have a global presence in China and India, for sure. In Ireland, it's just a fantastic place to do research with a very low cost compared to pretty much anywhere else.
It's not the same kind of brain drain where the people come here, they study, and they go back to their country. I mean, it is.
Oh, they do, because the guy who's setting up the India lab came here from India, and he's going back. He wanted to go back to India. He's still working for Lucent, yeah.
So you're not really completely losing people after they come over.
No, that's right. Nor do we lose the Chinese, who are really exceptional, extremely good at software in particular. But I've learned a lot about business in the last few years, a whole lot more than I did before I was a manager, that's for sure, or before a vice president. And I've spent a lot of time on my job when my boss came in from IBM. He wanted, and rightly so, to do strategy for all of research since we were in, I will say, economic free fall. We still wanted to do research, we still wanted to do science. We weren't exactly sure what amount of money we had, but we knew it was going down. And we had to spin off a number of companies and thus spin off part of the research. So I set up a research strategy process where we go by every year. What kind of science should we be doing? What kind of research should we be doing? And that has taken off on its own.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.